Doc Rivers continues to time and time again not get it when it comes to getting... Oh!
Let him play!
He wins. Great steak. Smells like poop.
Honestly, like if Urban Meyer wants to come to Connecticut, bring him on. I mean, come on. I'll take him too.
Nia Jackson, I think, weighs 280 pounds.
Oh!
Can we isolate that clip? Nia Jackson weighs 280 pounds. Oh!
Let her play.
From Los Angeles, this is Dave in the City, brought to you by Locks of the Week Radio. Now, here's Dave Medina.
Good evening, sports fans, and a pleasure to have you here for the big golf show. Good to have you with us from the Dave in the City studios in sunny Southern California. We're pleased to be continuing our little stretch run of the program. We've covered a lot of basketball, some hockey, and a little baseball and golf. And what a moment in golf for Gary Woodland, the winner of the 2019 U.S. Open from Pebble Beach Golf Links in Monterey, Carmel, which, you know, it's in that entire Monterey Peninsula. Beautiful area. I was privileged to give it a look recently. And just a great tournament. Really good stuff. So we're going to cover all the particulars of that tournament with John and Mike. We'll talk about the surprises and the disappointments, a lot of them this year with this tournament. Then we'll look ahead to the rest of the golf schedule in the near future. And then preview the Open Championship down the road next month, and that'll wrap it up for the golf season just like that, because the PGA got moved up to May. So much to talk about there. A reminder for general podcast purposes, we're going to take next week off, so we won't have any shows. No NBA report has been great. We've really had a great run. And Chris and I will take a breather. And random questions, you know, I thought about it, but I think we'll just take the week off, and we'll be back about 2 weeks from now. So let's send it off with some good golf talk, and let's bring in our panel. And we'll start with Mike in North Jersey. Mike, good to have you back. How's it going tonight?
Dave, I'm doing pretty well, even though I got both the NBA Finals prediction, although you can put an asterisk next to that one because Durant getting re-injured and Thompson blowing out his ACL. I mean, if we'd known about that, it would have been a different prediction. And I got my NHL Stanley Cup prediction wrong, which unfortunately I wagered on. And, you know, I did something pretty dumb during Game 7. Instead of, like, I doubled down on the Bruins instead of making a bet on St. Louis in Game 7, where then, okay, no matter what would have happened in Game 7, I would have won some money. And then I thought about it afterwards. I'm like, man, you're a fucking idiot, Mike. But other than that, I'm doing pretty well.
That's an interesting decision, isn't it? Like the hedge is always a very fascinating option. Alas on that. Man, that's too bad. But all the credit to St. Louis. That was pretty cool to see. You know, first time champion in the NHL. I always enjoy that stuff. So very good. So let's bring in John too. John, welcome back to the show. How's it going tonight?
I'm doing pretty well, Dave. Yeah, I was way off on my prediction. I think I said Warriors in five, but you know, with the caveat that Durant and Thompson got injured, if I had known that, it would have been a much different pick. I might have said Warriors in seven instead of sounding like a fool. But I did my usual golf league tonight. I started out looking like a complete hack, like topping two shots on the first hole, but ended up recovering and had a 40 for nine holes, which is pretty good. So I guess it's just, you know, getting there straight from work, I guess you're just kind of tense and you need a couple holes to warm up, but ended up pretty well. So that's going pretty well so far this season.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot of fun. So I'm glad that you rebounded within the round as you did, John. Good stuff. And hopefully, do you guys have like a record in the standings?
Yeah, there's like 14 teams, and I'm partnered up with somebody, and it's you know, it's a good way to kind of keep the competitive juices flowing. I mean, like there's like, you know, one day tournaments and stuff that I could do, but I enjoy this much better. There's a little less pressure than that, and a lot more beer, so that's a good thing.
I like the beer. It's a good call. Let me ask an unrelated question, and we'll swing it to Mike before we start. The FanDuel scenario, did you guys end up finishing in the money?
John won.
Oh, John won the thing.
Congratulations on that, John.
Tremendous job, John. Well done.
Yes, and I was our group text, I was like really just trying to get the cut to move because it was staying at one over for a long time. And the weather on Friday afternoon, it kind of maybe firmed up a little bit. And it moved the cut to two over, and I got like three of my guys that finished on the cut line into the weekend, which was huge because one of them was Cantlay, who ended up finishing in the top 20. Another one was my low salary pick, Colin Morikawa. He's a just turned pro. He had a top 15 at the Canadian Open, and I finished. And I figured, might as well just take a shot at someone like that, rather than like an old has-been journeyman tour pro who's never going to have a chance. And he was up and down, but he made a ton of birdies. I think he made like six or seven birdies on Sunday, and that was huge for fantasy golf. You rather have, if someone's going to have like around an even par round, you rather have six or seven birdies versus 18 pars. So that was huge. And then Matsuyama made a little climb with the leaderboard. And then Webb Simpson, too, started the cut, made the cut right on the number, and he ended up shooting 5 under the last day. Then obviously I had Brooks Koepka, so he got me a lot of points. But yeah, so what didn't look so great actually turned out to be, I ended up having a really nice lineup, and I won our little scenario. So that's 2 out of 3 of the majors so far this year. I didn't do well at the PGA, but I'll take the wins at the Masters and the U.S. Open for sure.
Yeah, I like it. Very well done. So, there was a lot of juice in that FanDuel this year, and Mike was in the mix too. I was never in it because of jackasses like Richard H. Lee and Brendan Todd, and I think I had somebody else who wasn't even that good that I was supposed to do a lot better than he did. And I'm trying to look it up, but that's what happens. There's a lot of luck involved too, so it was a lot of fun. I'm glad to be in it. So, good stuff. So let's get to the tournament at hand. And Gary Woodland, how about that? A guy that hadn't won a major before. You don't hear from him a whole lot. Mike will give you the whole dossier on his career, but he was tough. And, many had doubted. I mean, Mike and I both thought that he was going to fall off a lot. I think John did too after the second round. And he just kept going. And he was making great shots. His driver ability was great. And he was just tough. And made some terrific shots in the final round on Sunday. And held off Brooks Koepka, who had a good run going on his own. And even some others were coming up on them. Although, by the 10th hole, it was really a two-person race. And Gary Woodland outlasted Koepka. But he did kind of ice it. With about a hole and a half to go. I mean, he did make some terrific shots. There were a lot of danger, got out of it. And Woodland, who seems like a really good guy, they showed a piece on Fox during the U.S. Open coverage of him with a special needs child. And he was really making her day a dream come true. That was pretty awesome. And he was really soaking it in. And then... And in that same clip, you had Matt Kuchar just standing there. That was awkward, but overall, pretty cool to see that. So Gary Woodland, it was really his weekend, and I was happy for it. So Mike, your thoughts on Woodland and the performance he had over these four rounds?
I would say that this was a win by a player that. He didn't come out of nowhere. This isn't like Ben Curtis or Sean McKeel or something like that. I mean, the guy was ranked around 30th in the world. We all know that he does have a lot of talent. And years ago, if you had said, Gary Woodland, he's going to win a major, you probably would have said, well, yeah, I could see that. But, he won his first event in, I think it was back in 2011 now. And since then, he's only won two more. Now it would be four total wins, including this U.S. Open, but only three wins over 8 years. When something like that happens and, he kind of toils around and, he's not in danger of losing his card or anything, but he just kind of toils around as a guy who's a regular tour pro in the mix. You kind of forget about people like that. But if you look at his recent form, I was going back and looking at it. It was like, well, maybe we could have seen this coming a little bit, but with just, Brooks Koepka and his recent performances and we all knew about DJ's history and the Tiger hype train going completely off the tracks. And we'll get into that later because, I mean, just some of the stuff leading into this tournament about him was insane. But he kind of got lost in the shuffle here. And then the other big thing about him was, well, he was 0-for-7 going into this week. He's now 1-for-8 with 54 hole leads. So you think, is a guy like that really going to get it done in the clutch? And the other thing I would say about him, it's like, look, if a tour pro hits a really bad swing, I can kind of tell. But in most cases, when they hit a bad shot, it's just like 1 degree closed or open. And you can't really tell much difference on the naked eye when you see him hit the swing. But I've seen Gary Woodland a few times. You could just see naked eye, real-time camera, that his swing gets out of whack and it, like, his legs start going, or his lower body starts going too fast and he gets out of sync. So I was thinking, and I know I sent you guys this text, like, there's no way he's going to hold up here. He's going to fall apart. But you got to give him a ton of credit here. I mean, he started to slip a little bit on Sunday. Brooks Koepka obviously made a charge, turned the heat up on him, but he, you know, he remained really steady, and he was able to take advantage of the 2 par 5s on the back nine, which is what he needed to do, and he ended up with a 3-shot win. So great job by him. What I would say is the feel-good story about this is that I didn't particularly know this about him, but apparently he's very well-liked by almost everyone on the tour. And then obviously the work he's done with the girl with Down syndrome, it's been really touching to see. So it's just been this outpouring of support and, you know, happiness to see Gary Woodland have won this event. To get a little more specific about what he did, I'll point to actually a couple, before I get to the final round, a couple instances in his second round where he was putting on a run and he was able to separate himself. Now, he played on Friday. He played the back nine first, so he finished up on 8 and 9. And he's on a run, and on 8, he misses short of the green, and he pitches back up, and he leaves himself like 15, 20 feet for par. But he's above the hole. Now, as you guys saw the 8th green, it's treacherous, and if you're above the hole there, there's a good chance if you hit that putt, you're going to go 10 feet past. But he makes a 15-foot putt for par. Then he gets to 9, and he puts his approach shot just off the green, like on the fringe, on the edge of the fairway, excuse me, and he's got about 30 feet. So you figure, all right, this is a par, probably, maybe possibly a bogey if he free putts. And he sinks the putt, and that just put him in such a great spot going into the weekend that I think it gave him some momentum. And then Sunday, obviously, 2 shots that are going to be pretty iconic. The second shot on the par 5 14th, which is almost always plays as one of the most treacherous par 5s on the PGA Tour, just because that green complex with that huge and deep front bunker, it's just so difficult to get to. And I remember he pulls out 3 with it, and I'm just like, what is he doing here? Because, you know, if you go in a little bit low, you can plug that in the face of the bunker. If you take a kick off to the left, you can be in a place where you've got an impossible up and down. It leaves you in a spot where you can really get in a lot of trouble. And he pulls off really one of the great shots you'll ever see. He hits the 3-wood. It just clears that front bunker, gets caught up in the rough a little bit, bounces out, gets on the green, and rolls just off the green. Really, he had about maybe the size of a twin bed comforter to hit that shot onto to have it have a result like that, and he pulled it off. And then on 17... He does not replicate the great shot by Jack Nicklaus in 1972 with the 1-iron. He does something that probably, well, I won't say John would probably hit a pretty good shot. Something I would probably do standing up to 17 and flare it way out to the right onto the other half of the green and the way that green is pinched off, it's like you cannot putt it from over there, because if you do, it'll just kick left and basically go off the green. Or you can try to take it far enough right and putt it off the green, and it'll get stuck like Vid, one of your fantasy picks did, and I saw that live and almost fell off the couch laughing seeing that happen. But, you know, he pulls off a gutsy shot there. He hit a low – he didn't try to lob it. He hit a pretty low pitch shot pretty hard and was saying, okay, if I'll clip this clean – it'll get some backspin and it'll grab. And, you know, he almost sunk the damn thing. So that was just really a gutsy move there, because if he doesn't catch that perfectly clean, and I know you're thinking, well, it's a pitch shot, he's a torpedo. Yeah, but off of a green, off of a lie that tight, that can be a little bit tricky to do. But he pulled off the shot. He gets out of there with par, and then he goes to 18, and he's able to make his birdie there, which really that pretty much put the tournament out of reach. So a great job by Gary Woodland. Like I said, when we saw him come up to the PGA Tour with his prodigious length, his athletic background, he was a Division II basketball player. We wouldn't have been all that surprised to see him win a major, but he had kind of toiled in mediocrity. So a great job by him fulfilling the early potential that we saw. And it'll be interesting to see what happens from here. Does he become more of a force, or is this just like a one-off? I would kind of split the baby on that one. I think we'll maybe see him in the mix a couple more times, but I don't think he's going to turn into what Brooks Koepka has begun, but a great job by Gary Woodland.
Yeah, definitely. And the two shots you highlighted were really tremendous. And the one that I remember, and I definitely remember how bold both of those moves were. And I didn't even realize that you could actually chip the ball on the green. I didn't even know if that was legal, but you can do that apparently. And it was like you said, it was a risky decision. It doesn't get done very much in golf, and as you mentioned, it's what he had to do. My dad was breaking that down too. He's like, yeah, he couldn't putt it. It was just gonna roll right off, and he nailed it. It was a really great shot, and two moments in that final round, which essentially were turning points for his chances. Great job. And the other fantasy guy that I shall mention was Dustin Johnson, and he was never in it. What a mess. We'll get to that later. But first, John, let's get your thoughts on Gary Woodland.
Yeah, did you guys know that Gary Woodland was the Brooks Koepka of his day? That's what Paul Azinger said on one of the broadcasts.
We're getting to that too.
Over the weekend. Yeah, which makes absolutely. We'll get to him out later, but that was one of his comments. Yeah, this Gary Woodland, he was the Brooks Koepka of his day. That makes no fucking sense whatsoever. But that's besides the point. We'll get to Azinger and Fox, I'm sure. But, yeah, Mike did a great job there with breaking down, the final round and, some of the shots that Woodland had to hit. Those were the two, major key shots to his victory, hanging on for the win. If we look at Saturday, there was two other huge par saves. He was in trouble on the 12th hole off the green, and it made like a 20-foot putt for par. And then on 14, that same par 5 where he nailed the 3-wood on Sunday, he was in trouble and had like a 40-foot putt for par, and he drained it. So those were two huge par saves, which went a long way to him keeping his lead and eventually getting the win on Sunday. His swing did kind of start to leak oil a little bit. And this is another thing I'll just mention about Fox. They have no one analyzing swings. You see it on every other broadcast. You had someone analyzing a slow motion swing. CBS has Peter Costas. I'm not exactly sure who does it on NBC. It might be Gary Koch or Faraday, but they have someone analyzing a swing on NBC. They have no one analyzing a swing on Fox. And even, me, an amateur golfer, could see that Woodland was really getting quick with his swing. So his arms were out in front of his body, which leads you to block the shots. And you saw that in the 17th when he hit that slice. But, no one at Fox ever mentioned anything like that. And I'm sure someone who you know, maybe isn't as well versed in like the actual golf swing, wouldn't realize that. And that was just a terrible job out of them. But he played great for the 4 days. I wouldn't say he came out of nowhere, because like Mike said, he's a very solid tour pro. He really should have won the Tournament of Champions earlier this year in Hawaii. He played great all week for that tournament and shot 20 something under, but Xander Schauffele that day had like a 61 or a 62 in the final round and was just completely on fire and overtook him. But Woodland really should have won that event, and he seems to have gotten more consistent and I would say maybe not more accurate, but he's been using his huge length advantage to his benefit and more so getting more consistent with his finishes. And, you know, you saw that he won the Phoenix Open last year. Like I said, he should have won in Hawaii earlier this year. So he's becoming more consistent on tour and putting himself in a better position. So if you had told me before the week, yeah, Gary Woodland's going to win this, I mean, you know, it's not like, you know, a guy ranked 150th on the tour. Like, all right, I would have said, all right, I guess I could see that. I mean, he's a really long player, and if he can kind of find his accuracy and put it all together, I could have seen him winning it, but definitely would not have been on my list of top choices heading into the week. And he like Mike said, he just really does seem like a genuinely good guy. I mean, that story with him and the Down syndrome girl was really heartwarming, and you'd love to see that, like someone that's just a genuinely nice person and does that kind of thing for the community. And you know, he's not someone that you're going to root against, you know, like, if, you know, Bubba Watson or whoever on the screen, like you're rooting for them to go into the woods, or, you know, you can't root for this guy or Kuchar. I mean, you can definitely get behind Gary Woodland winning this tournament. So all in all, I mean, he handled the pressure well. I mean, his swing, like I said, was kind of starting to fall apart a little bit on the back nine with some of those shots, but he recovered very well. And I only think he made like four bogeys the entire week, which is insane for a U.S. Open. You think it's just, you know, you got to save par is the, and he did for the most part when he got into trouble. And that was another huge key to his victory, as I mentioned, with those par saves on the 12th and 14th hole on Saturday. And then when he was getting into some trouble on Sunday too, with his tee shots, he was always able to keep it in play and save par. So a great job for him. Is he going to win another major? I don't know. I mean, you could kind of, there is something to be said for once you win one, like you have just the confidence and you know you can do it. And he definitely has the game, as we saw. So would it shock me if he got another one? It wouldn't. I think more so he'll win like maybe three or four more times on tour and finish his career with, you know, eight or nine wins in one major, which is a great career. I mean, it's not a Hall of Fame career, but definitely better than the average tour pro. So I guess that's kind of what I would see for his career trajectory. But definitely an impressive performance this week, and he certainly deserved the win, beating the best player in the world in Brooks Koepka. And I'm sure we'll get to him in a little bit, but it was a very impressive performance by Woodland.
Yeah, all the props to Woodland, and it and what a moment for him. You mentioned the journey that he took to get here, and it was inside of a field that was pretty competitive throughout the weekend. There was juice every single day, and among that juice was the play of Brooks Koepka. A very good round. I mean, Woodland finished at 13 under. Is that the new record for the most under par, Mike, in a U.S. Open at Pebble Beach? Because I know they made a big deal about how Tiger had the record for a long time. Where does that rank in terms of like the farthest under 500, or I'm sorry, farthest under par in that scenario?
At Pebble Beach, I'm not 100%. I think Tiger was 12 under, but I mean, he won by 15 shots. So right. It's not an all time record. Rory was lower than that at, Congressional in 2011. I don't put so much weight into stuff like that just because it's so dependent on conditions and setups and stuff like that. Like for instance, you can't compare like this week to when they were at Marion 6 years ago and they just made that course extremely difficult, even though Pebble Beach and Marion are about the same length. So It was a pretty, yeah, it was a low score, but, and I guess we'll get more into this a little bit later. The wind didn't blow, and there had been a lot of rain leading up to this, so this was a pretty tame U.S. Open setup.
Yeah, that's true. There wasn't a lot of wind this year, and that's because it was mostly overcast. You tend to get the wind when it's clearer skies, so that's very true. It did actually work to be more or less favorable for the field. So let's talk about the rest of this field, a very good field, and some props to Shoffley as well. I think John alluded to this already, but he was 4-under on Sunday. That's really good. Koepka was a 3-under on Sunday, finished 10-under. Rahm was good. Some other, you know, Rose was doing well, and then he just had to blow up hole, and he couldn't rebound from that. And so we'll go from there. Let's talk about the rest of the field from this tournament, Mike.
Well, sure. I'll quickly start with Justin Rose because I got a little salvo to fire at him. Look, Justin Rose is a talented player. He has a U.S. Open. But I honestly think that, excuse me, at this point that Justin Rose is starting to get a little bit overrated in the golf circles. I mean, you hear him talked about, like, with DJ and Koepka, and you want to throw Tiger into that mix, and we still got to put Rory there, even though he hasn't won a major in 5 years now. He's not on that level. He isn't. He's very solid all around, although he does have a tendency to hit some very bad putts now and then. I mean, listen, he did a great job in that U.S. Open, although, let's be honest, Phil kind of threw that one away, unfortunately. But it is what it is. You don't apologize. He got a legitimate win, not taken away from him. But, you know, the guy has just, like, become such a disciple of Sean Foley. Now, listen, I said in one of our recent podcasts that I'm like, look, I probably bust Sean Foley's balls too much a little bit. But, I mean, the guy probably took a few years of Tiger being able to win majors away by trying to force him into this template swing. And once Tiger canned him and got healthy, now he's swinging much better than he ever did with Foley. And I was watching a run-up to this event, and I'm seeing Rose walk around with Sean Foley, and it's like they're on the green, and Sean Foley's like throwing balls in the rough and like talk to him. It's like, dude, what are you doing? Go on your own a little. Why are you listening to this like mechanical guy for every aspect of your game? Go around, place your freaking practice shots where you think, well, if I play this hole, I'm likely going to end up here. And if I miss, it's going to be in this place. And if the pin's here and I miss, it's going to be here. Why are you letting Sean Foley just randomly throw balls in the rough and then you hit your practice shot? It's just, you're too disengaged from the process. And he looks too mechanical. So wasn't surprised to see him fall apart. And now, because I'm kind of on a roll here, Ricky Fowler, who, if I had a brain, I should have bet my every cent of my net worth that he would shoot over par in that second round after he had the lead. I mean, you knew that was going to happen. And all we hear about before every single frickin' major, well, you know, Ricky Fowler, he might break out this week. No, he's not going to break out this week. He is what he is at this point. We know what he is. He's a good player. He's I won't say decent. He is a good player. But he is not on the level with the top players. Similar to, I mean, I think that a lot of people in the golf media have started to realize that. So you are starting to see it backed off a little bit. But, I mean, there's just way too much attention paid to the guy. I mean, and listen, he seems like he's a good guy, but at some point you have to be judged by what you do on the golf course. And the fact that so many kids look up and say, he's my favorite golfer. Well, you know what? If you aspire to mediocrity, and I know I'm sounding like a Republican right now, but it's true. If you aspire to mediocrity, what are you doing? You got to aspire to greatness. You don't aspire to be some guy who's all right, he's a good tour pro and he dresses in orange, so he gets some notoriety. No, that guy shouldn't be your favorite golfer. I'm sorry. So a predictable collapse by him. Dustin Johnson, just this was very disappointing. The guy has such a good history here. I mean, we know that he blew up in 2010, but he was very young then. He still had some, he still had a lot of learning to do. We've seen him get his major in 2016 at the U.S. Open. So you figured he'd have a good week, but he wasn't in it at all. So that was surprising. Touching a couple more. Rory McIlroy, now look, I know that many times over the years on this show, I have destroyed people for, like, going nuts over Tiger Woods winning some regular tour events. So I do need to pump the brakes a little bit on the Rory Canadian Open performance, although I will say that's the first time we've seen Rory have a performance like that since before he hurt his ankle in 2015. So that was good to see. It was good to see him actually make a cut in the U.S. Open. But look, he was probably too far back on Sunday to really make a run, so I can't kill him. But still, he should have done better on Sunday. He had three double bogeys for the week, and you just can't do that. But overall, a solid performance for him on a course that takes away drivers so often. So I didn't particularly think this course would suit him. So all in all, a decent job by him. And now he's got the major at Royal Portrush, where he has the course record, which he shot as a 16-year-old. And it's basically right around the corner from where he grew up. So definitely be some added pressure on him. And I guess now we can move on to Stoned Rory, a.k.a. Victor Hovland, the amateur, who I actually watched a good deal of the final 36-hole match of the U.S. Amateur last year, because it was at Pebble Beach, and I figured, well, you actually see the course without the likes of Chris Berman and Fortune 500 CEOs hacking it up all over the place, so it might be a good experience. And I said to myself in that, I'm like, you know, I know this is an amateur event, and I know this course is not set up anything like it will be for the U.S. Open. But if this kid plays like this in a tour event or a major, he'd do pretty well. And he finished in 12th place. He broke a record held by Jack Nicklaus for lowest score by an amateur in a in a U.S. Open, which, look, again, that comes down to conditions and whatnot. And I mean, Jack Nicklaus, the year that he set that record that got broken, he almost won the damn U.S. Open. So not quite the same, but very good job by Victor Hovland. And I guess one more golfer I get to, Tiger Woods, who I can't believe he didn't win, because if you listen to anyone over the last week, they would have told you that he shot the greatest round in the history of golf in the final round of the Memorial, even though he was about 15 shots off the lead and had no pressure on him. He might as well have been going out and playing a Sunday round for his own leisure. But oh, no, 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 no. It was great. Look at that. Oh, what a great position he's in. Even though if you realistically look at his game at this point, even though you would say, well, Pebble Beach, you won't have to the driver that much. The point is, the guy still gets in too much trouble, and he's really going to be hard-pressed to do that well in a U.S. Open at this point with what his game is. So not very surprising there. And, of course, now we'll hear this again because, he did well on Sunday after getting off to a horrid start. But you can't put that much weight into how someone does when there's no pressure on them or when it's basically over. So I would say an overall predictable result by Tiger Woods. Oh, and I didn't talk about Brooks Koepka. I mean, I guess I thought we'd do a separate thing, but just real quickly on Brooks Koepka, John can get more into him. I looked at his back nine par fives. I don't think he made one birdie on either 18 or 14. So if you look at that, you would figure, well, shouldn't he be able to play those holes at three under, eight chances at that, and go three more under? You'd probably think yes. So if you look at it big picture-wise, that probably cost Mr. Koepka there, although he's just on an incredible run, second, first, and second in the year's first three majors.
That's, you know, it's quite a run, isn't it? I mean, second, yeah, I mean, and he was about to, wasn't he like the two-time defending champion of the U.S. Open going into this tournament too, Mike?
Yes, he was.
So he was going for a three-peat, which is kind of unheard, which is unheard of in recent day golf. So really on a roll, and hey, I wouldn't count against him against in the British Open coming up either. So it's a good spot, and he really was playing very well. I mean, look at these rounds. I mean, even with all that he missed that you broke down, 69, 69, 68, 68. I mean, that's consistency. He was very, very good. So let's go to John and get your thoughts on the rest of the field, which I guess at this point would include the surprises and the disappointments.
Yeah, I mean, you know, look at the difference between Woodland was between three shots between him and Koepka, and then another three between Koepka and all the guys that tied for third. So, I mean, if not for Gary Woodland having the week of his life, I mean, Brooks Koepka wins another major. He, you know, and comfortably, that would have been three U.S. Opens in a row and, you know, three out of the last four. So he's just on another level right now. And it's funny because he's playing at the Travelers Championship this week, and I honestly would not expect him to do that well. Just coming off of the U.S. Open, and just probably really doesn't maybe care as much. I mean, I don't know. And it's certainly his prerogative. I mean, he's got to play a number of tournaments to fit his schedule. But I would not be surprised if he didn't do so well this week. But just what an unbelievable player. And he's just got the perfect attitude, as we've discussed, for the pressure of major championship golf. And he made some incredible par saves, too, on the back nine. He wouldn't even had a chance going to 18. And he just nuked that 3-iron on the 18th hole. Or otherwise, he could have been in there for an eagle if he took one less club. I mean, that was just right on the flag. But, you know, certainly nothing to be ashamed about with finishing second alone in the U.S. Open going for a three-peat. So he's clearly the best player in the world at the moment, and nobody can say otherwise. So we'll see if he can keep the major run going at Royal Portrush, and don't see why he wouldn't be in contention once again. And he lives for these majors. So as for some other players, well, let's mention Jon Rahm here. He gets a lot of criticism, and rightfully so, for his attitude. And there were some moments where you kind of thought that maybe he was going down to that well again, just blowing up after some bad holes. But he really hung in there, and other than Woodland and Koepka, he's the only other guy to shoot under par for the four rounds. And he shot 69, 70, 70, 68 for a total of seven unders. So he was under par for all four rounds and finished in third place. So a great job by him, and that's what we would like to see from him to contend in these majors. And I get it. He really didn't have a chance to win, per se. But to see him have a really high finish in a major was great to see. Xander Schauffele, he had another great tournament. You could see him breaking through for one of these majors soon. I mean, he definitely has the right kind of game for a tough golf course. Like, I wouldn't pick him at a course where you need to shoot, like, 25 under, like a birdie fest kind of course, even though he did win the Hawaii event, as I mentioned earlier this year. But that's only beating 30 guys. Like, if it's like a birdie fest major, I'm not going to be picking him. But kind of a tough U.S. Open kind of course, I can definitely see him winning one of these. So he had another great performance. I completely agree with Mike about Justin Rose. He's a really good, a top player, but he is not, you know, one of the best five in the world, in my opinion. And he was, even the fact that he was hanging in there, was his putting was just unbelievable. You knew his ball striking was not going to, if it didn't improve, he wasn't going to keep it up. And he couldn't make those par saves on Sunday, and he kind of faltered there, and it turned it into a two-man race. But still, it's a good finish for him in a major, tied for third. I mean, you know, he's not going to complain about that, especially when he had a chance to win. But that's probably the best that he could have finished, the way he was hitting the ball. It was just really poor. I guess the biggest surprise of the top guys was Chez Reavie, who you know, just one of your typical journeyman tour pros, but just hits it extremely straight and is a great putter. And, you know, that's just a great finish for him. Minus seven, tied for third, literally out of nowhere. Although I did see some kind of touts picking him for like a kind of a sleeper finish or for fantasy golf, and should have taken their advice. So that was a great finish. I think even, you know, we'll mention Fox in a minute, but I think at one point Paul Isner picked him to win the tournament, which is a little ridiculous. But I think he did take Reavie at one point, and that was a great finish for him. Yeah, so Tiger, that's going to be the greatest nine holes in the history of golf, his back nine there when he was shot four or five under to, you know, get a backdoor top 20. It's the same old shit with him from the media, and, you know, it'll be the same thing again. He'll be kind of average at the Open Championship, and maybe he'll finish good, and the hype machine will start again for next year. Let's see, who else here? Yeah, DJ, very, very disappointing. Definitely thought with his record at Pebble and the form he had coming in that he would have contended a little bit more. But it was not to be, was not his week. So definitely I'm sure he's very disappointed about that. And then Mickelson, I mean, I don't think anyone really expected anything out of him. Just the fact that he did win here earlier this year in February at Pebble Beach. But, you know, the course is a little different. And he's just so wayward with his drives. And the one thing about this course, and, you know, Mike kind of mentioned it, if the wind didn't blow, there was going to be low scores, because the only real defense for this course in terms of like very, very high scores is the wind. And the wind didn't blow, and the greens were kind of soft, because it was kind of like almost winter, spring-like conditions with like a morning mist and drizzle. It didn't look like a hard, fast golf course that you've seen at Pebble in previous years for the U.S. Open. So the only defense for the course with these conditions was the rough. And if you were in the rough off the tee, or if you didn't hit the green, you basically had no chance. I shouldn't say no chance, because you did see guys saving par, but if you hit it in the wrong spot in the rough and you were short-sighted yourself, you weren't going to save par. And it was very difficult. And with a guy like Mickelson, who just can't find the fairway, you know, he was not going to do well at this course. And for that matter, anyone who was off track, it was going to be very hard to play this course. If you were in the fairway, you could attack, and you saw that, because there was like 30 guys under par, which is pretty big for a U.S. Open leaderboard. And you saw a number of nice rounds, and the winner being at 13 under, that's a pretty low score. So I guess that's kind of the rundown of the field. Pretty much all the big names made the cut. Let me just see here who kind of missed the cut. I guess Justin Thomas, you would consider a big name, but he was coming back from a wrist injury, so we're not gonna hammer him too bad, because he's kind of still getting back into the swing of things. He was like really the only top player, I would say, that looks like that missed a cut. I mean, people love Tony Finau, but I mean, he only has one win on tour, so and again, not surprised he missed the cut, because like we've said, this is more of a ball striker's course, and he just his game is all about length, and this was just not a good course for him. So I guess those were the only two guys that were surprising that made the cut. So overall, pretty good field, and you know, we saw a lot of good scores and lots of good rounds and excitement over the weekend.
John, do you think that Matt Kuchar is in itself a surprise, because he finished in the top 20, really a top 15, but he's tied for 16th, so it's kind of the top 15.
Oh, not at all. I mean, this, like I said, this course was all about accuracy, and you know, he's a pretty accurate player and consistent player. So I am not surprised at all that he finished in the top 20. I honestly would have been surprised if he missed the cut or finished like 50th. I mean, he was never going to win, but that's like his typical finish for a major like this, is like, you know, 10th to 20th. So not at all. He pretty much finished exactly where I thought he would.
Okay, very good. So let's go to Mike. And I think that was pretty much everything. So you feel free to add any other flavor. We did talk about the course to start the show. And I mean, this course is so nice that it's worth spending some more time on it. Everything looked really nice. I think it was a beautiful setting, even though we didn't see very much sunlight during the tournament. But it was nonetheless a really good visual. And it was just great to have the U.S. Open again at Pebble Beach. You know, some of the iconic views, the the famous seventh hole, which is really tiny. Like, you know, you would never see this on any regular PGA Tour course hole at all. Like, it was like 100 yards, and then on one day it was like under 100, like 92. So, Mike, your thoughts on the course and the setup and all that smash?
Yeah, well, it's a very old layout, although I mean, it's been changed several times. I think the course dates back to the early 1900s, basically. And, you know, something like this today, well, first of all, you'd never get the land because it would be sold off for real estate development for, you know, people who are going to buy a home for $10 million and it's their fourth residence. But they complain about how much they have to pay in taxes, even though their fourth home costs $10 million. But so you would never see this type of land siphoned off for a golf course in today's world. Although, you know, every once in a while you see, like, abandoned dunes, for example. That's the middle of nowhere in Oregon, basically. So a unique piece of property. And just you see some like very bold designs that you wouldn't. Well, maybe now in today's world with this sort of this design philosophy that tries to harken back to the golden age of architecture. The big thing you see about Pebble is that you wouldn't see on like a typical resort course now is just these very small greens and. Just these bold features like, you know, something like 8 being like, you know what, let's cut a fairway off at about 250 yards and force everyone to hit like a, depending on where they put it, a 180 to 200 yard shot over the cliffs to the green. It's just, you wouldn't see something like that today. It's just really a unique piece of property. And it's really just that area in general is just it's spectacular to have golf courses there because most people would tell you that, you know, Pebble is not the best course even out there. It would be Cypress Point would at least in most lists that I've seen usually ranks ahead of Pebble Beach. So unfortunately, I don't think we will be seeing Cypress Point in, you know, any upcoming tournaments. It used to be part of the Pebble Beach Pro-Am, but their membership wasn't too open to accepting members of color, apparently, in the 1990s, and the PGA Tour removed them from the schedule. But getting back on point, it's a spectacular course, and I don't have any problem with the setup or how it played. I mean, look, on a course like that, if the wind doesn't blow, the scores are going to be low. That's just how it is. If you want to like look at the weather forecast and try to drastically do something at the last second to be like, well, you know, we don't have the wind here. We need to make this difficult. This needs to be like the U.S. Open. You would have to do things that frankly would be tricking out the golf course. And that's probably not the way to go. And of course, like Pebble Beach, you have to say, well, we're likely going to get some wind here. And if it doesn't blow, then you know what? You just accept low scores. I think a good example of that would be in 1992, there was I should remember the guy's name. I know he was actually a doctor. Like he had an MD. Tom Kite ended up winning it, but a guy was leading that tournament in 1992, the U.S. Open at Pebble Beach. He was like 12 under par in the second round. And he wound up, then the wind came in and he wound up finishing over par. I think Tom Kite at one point in that tournament on the seventh hole, which is about 100 yards downhill, he said he had a sand wedge one day and a four iron. The next day, just because it was hitting into like a gale force wind. So really a unique piece of property. The views are just unbelievable. And one thing this coverage and seeing this course in this tournament also brought out was forgetting all the ridiculous celebrities and CEOs and other sort of people just hitting terrible shots. The production value and the amount of effort they put into actually showing you some interesting views from around the course for the pro-am, it's just awful. I mean, they basically stake out a few camera positions. They just sit them there, and that's it. So I know it's getting a little bit off topic, but a stunning piece of property. It's quite amazing that they actually didn't go there for a U.S. Open until 1972. But ever since 1972, it's basically been a once every 10 years affair. And that will continue into the future as the... We actually won't even have to wait 10 years. The 2027 U.S. Open, which John and I will be 39 years old for, which is hard to believe, is scheduled for Pebble Beach. So we will be back here in, seems like a long time, but it won't feel like a very long time. So a terrific course, and it's nice that they will be going back there in short order.
Yeah, a lot was made about the architect or the pioneer behind the course, Samuel F.B. Morse, who if I remember reading when I was there, he was the same guy that invented the Morse code or someone related to them. That's pretty wild. And he was this close to seeing a U.S. Open in his lifetime, but he missed it just by a few months. So that was unfortunate, but his legacy lives on. And I think that part is very, very cool. So, is that the same guy? I think it is, right? I will try.
I don't know, Dave, but I would say the one thing that's interesting is that Pebble Beach does not have one of these like classic famous architects who did the course, like Alistair McKenzie did Cypress Point. He also did Augusta National. It's not like a Seth Rayner or a C.B. McDonald or a Tillinghast or a Donald Ross. So a relatively unknown architect, or even George Thomas, who did Riviera and Los Angeles Country Club. Not a well-known architect who was able to develop this spectacular golf course. So pretty unique there.
Yeah, it is. Wow. All right, let's go to John and get your thoughts on the course.
Nothing really else to add. I mean, it's a scenic course. There's, especially right on the water there, both the sixth, seventh, eighth holes. I mean, really doesn't get much better than that in terms of, you know, the way you could design a golf course. I mean, you're never going to see that again, especially because of just how they cut it out of the land to create those holes. And I think, I forget who it was, but they it might have been Gil Hance who does a really good job on the broadcast, and they bring him in for a short period of time. He said something like, when you design a course, you kind of like route it as how what the land gives you. But they what the Pebble architects did, it's as if they knew what they wanted with the seventh hole, and they kind of forced the sixth and eighth holes around it. And obviously the seventh is that short little par three we've been talking about, because most of the time you're not going to want to have an uphill blind tee shot, which is what you have on both the sixth and the eighth holes. And, you know, and in order to get that, they had to force the seventh in there. So that was pretty interesting. It's just a gorgeous scenery, and I'm glad that we get to see it for four rounds. As opposed to when we see it in February, the pros really only play on it. We only get to see it for one full round. I mean, they do show it here and there when they do the rotation of the courses. And most of the time it's the Fortune 500 CEOs and Chris Berman and Larry the Cable Guy and all those idiots that we get to see play the course. So it's great to see actual professionals play the course as it should be played. And, you know, I love seeing the U.S. Open on the West Coast, too. So for the primetime golf, at least for us on the East Coast, it's not so much for you, Dave. But love, you know, like Saturday, it went from 6 to 10:30. I mean, that was perfect to, you know, get your own round of golf in and then be home for 6 o'clock for the leaders to tee off. So that's excellent. So I love seeing the U.S. Open on the West Coast, and I'm glad that it's heading back there in 8 years. And, yes, I'm sure that it will be here before we know it, which is very scary. But where they say that the days are long, but the years are short. So I guess it's kind of fitting for talking about the U.S. Open going there again in, 2027.
Yeah, and it really has been quite a delight to watch. And I do like the later golf rounds. It actually does make some, even on the West Coast, it does make for some very interesting television. Because the idea that you can go all the way until like 2:45 and then have guys tee off, that's definitely unique. And I can imagine on the East Coast that's even more unique, because like, we're almost six when some of the leaders are teeing off, so definitely unusual. Morse is not the same Morse who invented the Morse code, because I'm off by about 100 years with that, but he's related to that Samuel Morse, so it's kind of cool. Like, there is a relation, I think the situation was, I can't remember, but he's a descendant of the original Morse who did in fact invent the Morse code, but not literally the same guy, because I think he invented the Morse code in the 1800s or something like that, so it's like, that could not have been possible to live a 200 years and then be around for Pebble Beach. So just to clarify that for everybody. So now let's talk about the broadcast. And yeah, I mean, John already hit some of the points, and I think doing the primetime coverage is a home run. Like that is a very cool, And I hope that the ratings reflected very good increases in the ratings because of the ability to go primetime. Pretty neat. But other than the time scheduling and just seeing Pebble Beach, I gotta tell you, even for Fox, this is this is a miserable broadcast. They did a horrible job. I will point out a couple of positives from the broadcast. Number one, going to Joel Klatt for interviews, I thought he was fine. Like, it was certainly an improvement over Holly Saunders. I didn't think much of her at that point when she was there. I don't know if there was a falling out or what, but having Joel Klatt, who's not even a golf guy, doing the interviews, he did okay. I mean, you guys may just defer on that, but I thought he was fine. Yeah, that's it. The highlight of the broadcast was when Jim Nantz went on the show in the booth with Joe Buck and Paul Azinger, and really that was really the best. And like you guys are saying in the text, like they should have just kept him there the whole time, and then just had Joe Buck and Jim Nantz do the whole coverage. That would have been a big improvement. Anyway, I won't ramble anymore. Mike, let's give it to you for your thoughts on the broadcast.
You know what, Dave? I'll actually say, because John seems like he has some specifics on Azinger's ineptitude, why don't you throw it to him first and let him tee off on our friend, Mr. Azinger.
I like that. Yeah, you're right. And you were kind of getting to it at the beginning of the show. So, John, you have the floor.
All right. Well, first, let me start with the positives first, because it can't all be bad. I actually agree on Joel Klatt, and apparently he's just a huge golf nut, so it made sense for him to, or for them to bring him in, and I thought he did a really good job, so I agree with you there. The interviews were not a problem. The primetime scenario, as I mentioned, love that. So I think we mentioned on our last podcast that the PGA next year is going to Harding Park in San Francisco. Let's hope that CBS takes the same track with the primetime golf. I don't know if they'd want to bump 60 minutes. That's a whole other question, but that, you know, love the schedule of the primetime golf. You can't complain with the hours, the amount of coverage. I mean, you pretty much get everything. It's not like the Open Championship next month where you literally, if you woke up at 1 in the morning, you could watch every single basically shot from 1 a.m. till it's over. So it's not that amount of coverage, but you get a lot of coverage for this event. And then the early stuff that you can't see on TV, you can get on the featured groups on the USGA website or the Fox Sports Go app. So you can't complain about that. So that's great. I like the shot trails, behind each player. And you can really see, like Woodland's shot, for example, on 17. You could really see that slicing off with the shot trail, and those are very helpful, and you can kind of see it match up with how the swing looks too, which is good. So I think all those things are good. I guess I'll mention one other person that I like on the broadcast. I think Shane Bacon does a really good job, and he actually was close to qualifying for the U.S. Open, so he's a good golfer, and I think he does a pretty good job. So those are all the positives. Now let's get to some negatives. For whatever reason, I thought Joe Buck was more worthless than usual this time, and I don't know why. Maybe just because it just got so annoying. He all he said for 95% of the broadcast was he was just saying, okay, Woodland, Gary Woodland, second shot at 17. Brooks Koepka for birdie on 15. Like, he added, all he was doing was just narrating what we were seeing in front of us. And I guess it's kind of his job as our the play-by-play man, but it, Nance adds commentary. He says it in a way that is enjoyable. That's all Buck did was Tiger Woods second shot 17. Like, he didn't add anything. I don't know if you guys noticed that. Like, he literally did not add anything for 90% of the broadcast other than that. However, compared to Azinger, Buck was amazing. The more we're seeing of this guy, he's just terrible. He adds nothing to the broadcast. And I'll mention three things that just annoyed me to no end. Number one, I think at one point he picked at least five guys to win the tournament at one point or another. He was picking he picked Gary Woodland at one point. He picked Brooks Koepka. He picked Ches Reavie, as I mentioned. Oh, the way this guy's putting, how could you pick against him? He was even he picked Justin Rose. At one point he picked Henrik Stenson or Adam Scott when they had literally no chance in hell to win this tournament. Oh, if they post 8-under, they can see what happened. Paul, Woodland's freaking 12-under. How are they going to get with 10 holes to play? How are they going to catch him? It was just so annoying. He was picking every player and saying these ridiculous cliches that made no sense at all. And then what might even have been more annoying than that, it's like, you're an analyst. Like, give me something here. And all he would do after every shot would be, oh, my God, look at this. Wow, great shot. Like, me, you, or Mike could have given that analysis. And then when someone does hit, you know, the guy hits the shot and it goes way into the, you know, way right into the rough or whatever, he goes, oh, man, that's dead. He's got no chance there. And then a second later, well, maybe he's got a little bit of room to hit the shot. Like, give us something. Like, take a path and stick with it. Like, either he has a chance to do the shot or he has no chance. Like, pick something and stick with it. That was just super annoying. He added nothing in terms of that. And just in general, in no swing analysis, it's always about the, like, a mental aspect with him. It's never about the actual technical. And I know golf, a big part of the golf is the mental state and mental game, but give us a little something here about why someone's slicing the ball or what, you know, what clubs they should be hitting or a strategy on the hole. Like, he gave you nothing. And the fact that he's NBC's lead announcer, it's really a shame because he is just not cut out for this. So in my opinion, he was the biggest problem with the broadcast. He literally gave you nothing. And it was bad enough with Buck just being a robot saying who we were watching on the screen. And then for him to be like, oh my God, what a shot. Like, okay, I can see it's a great shot. Give us a little something more than that. So, for those reasons alone, it was just a horrible performance. And I don't know, NBC's got to do something because he cannot, you know, if he wants to parachute in once a year and for us to deal with him on Fox, whatever, we'll deal with it. But for him to be NBC's lead announcer, I think they have to make a switch.
Yeah, I wonder how long it'll be before they come to that conclusion, because to have that every week is going to be rough. I mean, imagine the drop-off of analysis from Johnny Miller to Paul Azinger. And I'll go back and I'll go give it to Mike now for his thoughts on the Fox broadcast of this tournament. But looking ahead, it does not look pretty. I'm a more casual golf follower, and I was just getting irritated by all these stupid things he was saying throughout the entire weekend. I mean, I brought up the idiotic analogies he brings up. Like, he compared people on the beach watching watching Pebble Beach from a distance to extra inning baseball, which makes no sense. It's like, you have to pay to get into baseball to get to extra inning baseball. Like, how is that the same thing? It's like, even stuff like that was annoying. So, Mike, let's get your thoughts on the broadcast.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I was thinking, I'm like, didn't I tweet about something that he said that made an analogy that made absolutely no sense? And that was exactly it. He compared the people that were on, like, a free access public beach to people who had paid to get into a stadium or an arena or whatever, that got to see a few extra minutes of of whatever sport they were watching. It's not the same at all. Like, what is he talking about? And, you know, I'm actually going to make a point of this, because
unfortunately, we're going to be subjected to Azinger for our next major, with it being on Golf Channel NBC. I'm actually going to make a point to like write down actually some of the stupid stuff that he says, because it's just it's so much that, like, I think what happens to me now, full disclosure, I did miss Saturday. I mean, I was following on my phone, obviously, the whole time on Saturday, but I was at a wedding Saturday, so I missed the broadcast. So that, and I think what's happening with Azinger is, like, I'm just, like, tuning him out, or, like, just shutting off my mind, being like, I'm just not going to listen to this. It's just going to annoy me. But just in general, he brings nothing to the broadcast. He never makes a point that, like, is salient or intelligent or whatever. He just shoots out stupid cliches and crap about the mental game. And it's like, you know, Johnny Miller would take guys to task and he'd be like, well, you know, he fucked up on this with his swing. And this is what's going on with him. Or if a guy was choking, he'd say he was choking. And Faldo, he kind of understands what's going on with the swing, and he'll get on people for course management mistakes. And that's a big thing, is that Faldo and Miller would always get on to, if a guy's not playing a hole right, they would be on it. And they would know from this lie and this type of shot what you have to pull off and if the player is suited to that and whatever. And he does none of that. It's just... It's like he's, you know, they'd almost be better off bringing Greg Norman back on, because at least Greg Norman did a little bit of research on inner ear infections and how they'll affect your balance when people just rip them apart for the whole Jason Day thing, although he didn't have much else to say. But I think being quiet is probably better than doing what Azinger does. So I will make a point to actually write down some of the inane stuff he says, but oh my God, just having this guy for now basically half of the regular tournaments and two of the majors, that's going to be tough to take. And what maybe even worse is that, I mean, you already discussed that Nance was on, and it was just like, you know, can we just keep him here and send Joe Buck home? And they also had Johnny Miller on, and it was just supposed to, like, I read about it, and I did see the segment. But I read about it beforehand. It's like, well, he's not going to be announcing. It's just going to be an interview with Joe Klatt, who I agree, he did a very good job. But while they're interviewing him, like, play's going on, and I guess Miller just instinctively, like, started announcing, like, what was going on. So at that point, it's like, well, can we just keep Johnny here and just send Azinger home? And like that would have been how cool would that have been if, you know, Fox just sent home Buck and Azinger and just gone with Nance and Johnny Miller, just wrote him a blank check. Or, I mean, obviously that never happened, but it would have led to a much better broadcast. One thing that was missing this year, and unless I missed it, which I could have, because, you know, my I was in upstate New York at Saturday, and I drove back and I got home in time to see the leaders tee off. But I know a running thing that I found funny about the Fox broadcast was the weekend morning Irish announcing crew with, like, I think the guy's name was Tom O'Donohue or something. And then they had Darren Clark too. And it's like, you could barely understand what they were saying. And there's just, but I don't think they were around this year, so that was too bad. Gil Hance does a good job with the golf architecture stuff. The one thing you do have to give Fox credit for was just all these hours of coverage, which finally it's nice to see, because with how the majors have been laid out this year, we got the Masters, which we know the TV coverage is limited, granted with very good streaming coverage, so that kind of supplements it. And then the PGA with, you know, thank God TNT is gone. Just with the, yeah, you know, we're not going to go on the air until 1 o'clock on the weekdays. It's like, dude, what are you doing? So getting to see this extended coverage, and I do think the streaming coverage was pretty good. I didn't listen to any of the commentary on it because I was at work, so I had it on silent. But just being able to switch between two featured groups, and featured holes, which the PGA Championship streaming app did not have, and no commercials, I don't think. So good job by them with that. Look, they've come a long way. Now, granted, I don't want to give them too much credit for that because they were so bad the first year. It was just, it was really unbelievable. But they have gotten a lot better. Now, look, the broadcast obviously is going to be very limited in its quality as long as you have Joe Buck and Paul Azinger leading it. I mean, if you just brought in Shane, honestly, if you went with Shane Bacon and Brad Faxon for the whole thing, it would be a lot better. But that's never going to happen, unfortunately. And, yeah, it definitely should be mentioned that Shane Bacon made it to the final sectional qualifying of the U.S. Open, which is really just incredible. That's an incredible accomplishment, frankly. I mean, if you're able to get to that, you're a pretty damn good golfer. So great job by him. But John's right with a couple things. They have no one to analyze swings, which is a little weird. You know, things just, although they did get rid of what's her name this year, right? Who was the
Saunders?
Woman they had on? Not Holly Saunders, who, let's face it, had to go. She's too busy trying to be Kim Kardashian.
That's
even
right.
Though she did. It's true. Even though she played Division I college golf, you would think she would be able to make some salient points, but not really.
Wow.
Who am I thinking of? She's a LPGA player. She was a pretty good one.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Julie, I know who you're Angster. Talking about.
Julie Angster. She's been hand waved, right? Yeah. So no more Julie Angster. They seem to be getting a better direction of where they're wanting to go. So, look, it's not the worst thing in the world. It's a lot of coverage, definitely better than TNT. But, you know, with ESPN getting in the game next year, although if they show up with our friend Chris Berman, I might go back on this. Fox is going to have to try to step it up a little bit. And I guess one other thing I should touch on, the ratings apparently were pretty damn good. Now, I hope that part of this, obviously the prime time helps, but I hope that part of this is being that Brooks Koepka is just doing so well that finally, people are getting compelled to say, if he's in it, I got to turn on the TV. If we can finally get some of the Tiger-only fans to say, hey, this guy's playing, I gotta watch golf. That's really, really what this game needs because, I mean, the way it is right now, and the media does not help this with their constant ridiculous narratives about Tiger, when the guy's playing the senior tour, these people are never going to watch golf again. So hopefully that is the case. The prime time, it is a lot of fun. John's right. You can go in and you can play some golf there in the afternoon and get back in time to watch the leaders. And frankly, it saved my bacon this weekend because I was rolling back into New Jersey about 4:30 after being up in the Finger Lakes. So thankfully it was prime time. So extensive coverage from Fox, not horrible, but they really got to do something about this whole Buck and Azinger combo if they want to step it up going forward.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I will also endorse Bacon and Faxon because I think I told you guys about that. Just kind of parachuting in, and I thought those guys are pretty good too. So it would be I too would be just fine if they just did the whole thing, but probably not going to happen. So let's move ahead, and we will go to the upcoming schedule. And John will be very familiar with next week's event, and so we'll give it to you first for what's coming up in the world of golf.
Yeah, Travelers Championship coming up this week. Course is 10 minutes from my house, so we'll definitely be in attendance this week. The weather is looking dicey tomorrow and early Friday, but the weekend is looking gorgeous. So if they, you know, were to get behind the schedule the next couple of days, I'm sure there'll be some delays. But I mean, the sunset here is first day of summer is on Friday, so I mean the sunset's going to be, you could play until about 8:45, so there'll be no problem with getting the tournament in. But it's a great field once again this year. Brooks Koepka is playing, Jordan Spieth, Phil Mickelson, Jason Day, Bryson DeChambeau, Paul Casey, Tony Finau, Tommy Fleetwood, just to name a few guys that are here and playing. Oh, Victor Hovland is here, the Norwegian high Rory, I guess we're going to call him from now on. I definitely can see that comparison. So I'm going to be interested. I might get a chance to watch him. So a great field, and it should be a fun tournament. I mean, the course always provides an exciting finish. I mean, you have that big lake. If anyone's familiar with the course, you have a big lake around the 15th, 16th, and 17th holes. You have the 15th is a drivable par 4. It's only like 290 yards, and all the pros go for it. But there's water on the left side, and it's just a really fun hole. And then you have 16, the par 3, over the water. And 17 is a huge dog leg that goes around the lake. So there's trouble off the tee shot and over the the approach shot. So, you know, it usually provides a number of exciting finishes. You remember 2 years ago, Jordan Spieth hold the bunker shot in the playoff to win. And there's just there's an amphitheater setting around the 18th green. And it was just an unbelievable moment. I think it's voted by the players as like one of the most player-friendly events on the tour. And so it's not surprising that it continues to get the great fields year after year, and it's really cemented itself, especially after the U.S. Open, as one of the premier events, non-major events anyway. And this year, more so, because after this week, you have two unknown tournaments because it's their first year in existence. It's the Rocket Mortgage Classic, they're calling it, in Detroit. Now, this was the former spot where it would be the tournament in D.C., like a congressional or TPC of Avenel, I think it was called, and that was the tournament that would go to benefit the Tiger Woods Foundation. So I don't know for sure if he's involved in this new tournament. I want to say no, because they moved it to Detroit and has a whole new sponsor. So I'm thinking it's a brand new tournament and Tiger's not involved. And then the following week is a brand new tournament in Minnesota. It's called the 3M Open. And what's interesting about this tournament is it was not the exact same tournament, but they used the course for an event on the Champions Tour last year, the Senior Tour, and the Senior Tour players were shooting like 20 under. So I can only imagine what the scores are going to be on this course for the PGA Tour players. I mean, someone might be 30 under if that's what the seniors were doing. So that'll be interesting to see, I guess, just for that standpoint anyway. And I guess, you know, good for the tour to bring events to places that really haven't had any. And especially the fans in Minnesota, whenever they've had PGA championships there at, I want to say, Hazeltine's, the course, and Ryder Cups, they've always turned out well. So good for them. We'll see how that tournament goes. And then the John Deere Classic is just the usual event before the Open Championship, which will not be highly attended. So with that upcoming schedule, the Travelers is really in a great spot if that continues, especially going forward. And then after that is the Open Championship. I'm sure we'll get a preview about that. And, after that, there'll be a couple more tournaments before the FedEx Cup playoffs. And I will say the final World Golf Championship event of the year, and I think we've talked about this before, it's going to be the week after the Open Championship, and it's going to be played in Memphis in late July. I mean, that of all the changes the tour made for their schedule, that is by far the worst change, and that's going to backfire on them because that is just – I can't see many top players playing. I mean, I guess they're going to have to because it's a World Golf Championship event. I don't know how that works, but it's just going to be miserable for everybody involved playing there, number one, and especially right after the Open Championship. I think that's going to have to change in some way, shape, or form going forward, but we'll see how it goes this year. And interestingly enough, they have not announced the – full schedule for 2019-2020. Obviously, it starts in the fall, but it's going to start. The fall series is going to start in September this year because the FedEx Cup is done in August, and they have not announced anything. I know there's a couple new tournaments. I think they have a tournament in Japan that's in the works. I think there's a tournament in California that Steph Curry is somehow involved in. So lots of new stuff they're working on for the fall. And they've moved tournaments to the fall too. The Houston event and the Greenbrier tournament is moving to the fall. That tournament is usually played the week of the new tournament in Minnesota, so they kind of swap places. So it's an interesting schedule coming up, but definitely looking forward to being in the mix with the Travelers. I'll probably go like Friday afternoon and Sunday, so should be a fun week.
Yeah, that sounds like a great time. I mean, And I do hope you have a good time. I hope the weather cooperates too, John. That should really be fun. and a good visual too. And I do want to check it out this year, this weekend as well, see how it goes. And like you said, great field. Pretty much like, would you say it's sort of an East Coast level of version of the Genesis Open? Because it does seem to get similar kinds of a field. I mean, it's a very good field.
I think the one out in LA Day is a little better. Mm-hmm. I mean, we do have some top players coming here, but the strength of the field there is excellent every single year. I don't think it's quite as good here, but still, considering that, you know, it's on the East Coast the week after the tour played in Pebble Beach, I think it's still really good.
Yeah, that's a great turnout for coming that soon after a major. Good job out of the tournament for getting all that together. So let's go to Mike and let's get into the next Open Championship, the 148th of the Open Championships in Royal Potrush. This will take place in about a month from now, and you talked about it in the early part of the program. This is essentially Rory McIlroy's backyard. He's been playing better. You mentioned what he was doing in the Canadian Open. He did have a decent round until the last couple of rounds at Pebble Beach. A great opportunity for him. And I'm not about to say he's the favorite to win. He shouldn't be. I think Brooks Koepka should be the favorite to win. But he should. This is going to be a great moment, and I think he could very well rise to the occasion. So let's get your preview of this year's Open.
Sure. Well, I'll say that, and granted, some people might laugh, say, what are you doing that referencing a video game? But, someone created a perfect recreation of Royal Portrush in, games called the Golf Club 2019, which they actually had a very interesting, idea of how to do this. They only took a few TPC courses as officially licensed courses, and then they just let people, somehow people have the ability to do this, create these perfect recreations of like all the other great courses. So there's like absolutely down to the every blade of grass is correct recreations of Augusta National and Pebble Beach and, you know, take your pick. Basically, the only big one they don't have really is Cypress Point. But from if you just look at pictures of Royal Portrush and getting to go around it in this game, it seems like an absolutely incredible course. It's supposed to be one of the best in the world. Depending on what the storyline is, who wins, what happens, that can steal the show, but I do think this course is really going to steal the show. Now, with what's going to happen and who we can expect to see do well, look, you have to put Brooks Koepka as the favorite in every major going forward until he shows us that he's not going to be performing well in them, which we haven't seen any signs of that. But it's the Open Championship. So much is dependent on the wind, and where you fall in the draw, because unlike these other events, you know, everyone tees off on the first tee, and because over there in the summer they have like these incredibly long days, they're able to do that, just put twosomes off on the first tee and go through like that. So what oftentimes happens is, you know, the players that tee off in the morning, the first day, and the afternoon, the second day, have it much better off than the people who are in the afternoon and in the morning, or vice versa. So really conditions and the draw will determine who's going to do well there. In terms of difficulty, again, completely down to conditions. If it's tame, you're going to see some pretty low scores. If you got like 30 mile an hour winds, you lose. So it'll be interesting. And also, this is going to be held in Northern Ireland, which we know is it's part of the United Kingdom. Although there have been some, you know, it's really amazing to think, because it's something in the Western world. There was so much violence in Northern Ireland and right along the border for like many years. It basically only stopped like 20 years ago.
And one of the reasons you'll see that, like, Rory McIlroy is so reluctant to ever, like, dip his nose into anything regarding, well, am I Irish, am I British, is, like, his generation is the one that's, like, they've really grown up and realized, hey, we shouldn't be killing each other over this nonsense. And one of the interesting things about McIlroy, but you'll never hear him talk about this, is that his uncle was actually a victim of the violence. He was, his uncle was killed in the 1980s and the 1970s, I believe, by the Ulster Volunteer Force, who would have been the Protestant, like, terrorist group, kind of the counter to the Irish Republican Army. So it says a lot about what's happened in that region recently for the, you know, the RNA to award and open to, of course, in Northern Ireland. They have had it there once before in the 1950s, but it's going to be a historic event, really. And another good thing about that is Graham McDowell, who had kind of been toiling along for years and had been, his game had really slipped, but, you know, he made a 30-foot putt in the Canadian Open, which qualified, like, on his last hole, which was able to get him into a good enough finishing position to qualify for this Open. And he's also from Northern Ireland. So that's a great story. And then, you know, he played pretty well at this U.S. Open. So, I mean, I don't think he'll win or anything, but it's been nice to see Graham McDowell, who was always a guy that you could, who was pretty easy to root for. I see him doing well again. So, yeah, Koepka will be the favorite. I think Rory will be close in after that. Now, granted, there's going to be a lot of pressure on Rory, but we'll see. I mean, he did set the course record here as a 16-year-old. Granted, they've changed a couple holes in, since then, but it'll certainly be interesting to watch. And I guess just touch on a couple other things since we were talking about schedules. Yeah, really. It's good to see the Travelers doing well. You know, there's a good history of tournaments in the greater Connecticut area. I know they had the Sammy Davis Invitational for years around there, it was called. And, you know, my dad actually saw Ben Hogan play a hole up in a tournament in the greater Hartford area in the, was probably the 1960s at some point, mid-1960s. So good history there. It's nice to see this tournament's ramped up in prestige in the recent years. The one thing I'd say about these upcoming tournaments, it's nice that they've given Detroit and Minnesota events, but just looking at these courses, and maybe my opinion will change when I see them on TV, but they just don't seem to be very inspiring at all. Like, it definitely seems like the Greenbrier, which was this old classic place, it definitely seems like it's going to be a downgrade. But we'll see what happens. And, you know, John's exactly right. How the hell are you having a World Golf Championship in Memphis in the last week of July, the week after the Open Championship? I mean, that's going to be an absolute disaster. So, although the PGA Tour's hands were kind of tied by FedEx, because they sponsor the FedEx Cup, but really a very questionable decision there.
That's right. The FedEx has got a big pull in that. I forgot about that idea. Memphis is the home, but for those not familiar, Memphis is the headquarters of FedEx, the company. So, yeah, I can see why they did it now. That would make sense. That's pretty funny. So let's go back to John and let's talk about more Royal Portrush and what's to come in the Open. Any other thoughts on that?
Honestly, all I know is it's an extremely famous links course in Northern Ireland, and I did know about McIlroy having the course record. Other than that, I do not know anything about the course. So I think we'll leave it to Mike for that nice breakdown he gave. Obviously, I'm looking forward to the tournament and seeing what it can bring. It's maybe a little different than the traditional Scottish links courses that we typically see the open played on. But other than that, I really can't provide any insight in terms of the course. I'll have to I'll have to go look at that video game that he was talking about. That actually seems pretty awesome. But yeah, in terms of favorites, you know, you got to make Koepka the favorite at the moment. And of course, Rory is there. And I think a lot of the European players usually seem to do better at this event than the other majors. And I would expect that trend to continue, especially if the conditions become a factor. That's not to say that an American can't win, because Americans obviously have won the Open Championship, but you know, they seem to favor the European Tour players. And also, it seems like players with older players, like players with more experience, seem to do very well at the Open Championship. So certainly looking forward to that, but unfortunately I can't give you a more in-depth breakdown or thoughts about the course, because I frankly really don't know that much about it at this point.
Well, I don't either, and I got to give you a lot of credit, Mike. The background going into this tournament was exceptional. Really good job out of you, especially the part about Rory McIlroy and his background. He's been through a lot, I can see. So it will be a very emotional moment, I'm sure. And as you mentioned, history in the making, I think. So I'm looking forward to it. So with that all in the books, let's go for final thoughts for the moment, and then we'll enjoy some more golf the rest of the summer leading up to this Open. Mike, I'll give it to you for your final thoughts.
Yeah, I'd say that after the PGA Championship, I think it was pretty much a unanimous consent among us that, you know, this seemed to work out pretty well. There was extra juice for the PGA, and, you know, this has gone great. I'll say that right now, not that I'm regretting anything, but it does seem a little bit weird that, hey, we're sitting here in the middle of June. You know, I have my vacation. I'm going to Hilton Head next week, so getting a little golf in. Haven't even had my vacation yet. You know, we haven't had our 4th of July barbecues and the fireworks and the whatnot. And we only have one more major left to go. So I did kind of get this weird feeling after the U.S. Open, being like, you know, it feels a little bit odd that we only have one major left. But I guess that's the price you got to pay. It is kind of good having all of these 1, 2, 3, 4 in a row. But I do think we're going to be missing. We are going to be missing golf when August runs around. So it'll be a little bit interesting to see how the emotions play out in August, or how we feel after the final major of the year, which will be the British Open upcoming in July. And then I guess one other thing to look at is, you know, if Brooks Koepka can find a way to win the Open Championship coming up, I mean, think about it. He'll go second, first. It'll be one of the great all-time years in golf history. So I think if you want to root for a historical event, Koepka would obviously be the guy to be pulling for.
Love it. Well said, Mike. Let's go to John and get his final thoughts.
Yeah, it will definitely feel weird. I don't know, Dave, do you want to do a obviously we're going to do a program after the Open Championship in July, but how would you feel about it, like a season-long podcast after the Tour Championship is over? Because the FedEx Cup will be over, you know, third week of August. We can almost do like a season-long recap show in August and kind of get our entire thoughts on that. That's just an idea
going forward.
But, yeah. But, yeah, it should be a great major coming up. And, you know, the storylines in golf are just – I mean, it hasn't been a better place in years. Even, you know, with all these top players and so many storylines, and it's just a treat to watch. Even the smaller tournaments, I mean, there's always something going on. So, you know, it's the game is in a great place at the moment, and it's good to see. And always enjoy discussing it with you and Mike, and – you know, it's been a good time.
Yeah, it definitely was, and I owe you guys a lot for your great expertise. That was a lot of fun. I really like breaking this all down, guys. Enjoy the rest of your vacation. My goodness, Mike, that's great. Going back to Hilton Head, that's good stuff. Going to back to the Travelers, Mike. I mean, John, that's good stuff. Nothing really planned in the immediate future. I haven't figured out the 4th of July weekend yet. But we'll see. I mean, by the way, you know, San Diego's come, and Torrey Pines is going to be having a U.S. Open in the near future. Like, I think they're like 2 years away from that, like 2021 or something like that.
Yeah, you know, Dave, you also got, besides that, you have, there's going to be U.S. Open at L.A. Country Club,
yes.
Actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's even sooner. I think that's next year, right?
No, that's, let me look at real quick.
Maybe 20.
Next year is, it's Wingfoot.
Wingfoot, right, yeah. Wingfoot. Yeah. Is that your Mike? Because that's in upstate New York.
Oh, yeah. Listen, I haven't been as good about going to golf tournaments in person in the last couple of years, but that one is really close to me. So I don't see how I'm not going to get over there for a round. Let's see here. Future sites. Okay. So yeah, Wingfoot next year, Torrey Pines, 2021.
Yeah.
2022, the Country Club, Brookline, Massachusetts. Great course, perennial top like 20 course in the country. I know the membership there was really pissed off because they thought they were going to get the 2013 U.S. Open because it was the 100-year anniversary of Francis We Met winning that U.S. Open, which is a very historical win in golf, but they gave it to Marion. Four more years, 2023, the North Course at Los Angeles Country Club. You will be having, so you, well, San Diego. What is San Diego, like 2 hours from you?
San Diego is about, yeah, maybe two and a half. But if you're talking about Torrey Pines, that's actually about 30 minutes north of San Diego anyway. So, yeah, it's exactly 2 hours from where I live.
Yeah, 2 hours. All right. So, yeah, you got two U.S. Opens in your vicinity in the next 4 years, so enjoy it, Vid.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, and it was tempting to go to Pebble Beach too. Like I just you know, it was very much on the tip of my tongue and just didn't quite work out. So but yeah, this is an exciting time for California. No doubt. All right, guys, well, thanks again. Enjoy all your trips and whatever you're up to with golf. We'll be back at it in about a month. Have a good one, everybody.
All right, Dave. Thanks.
See you.
All right, fellas, take care. Good times again. That was John in Connecticut. That was Mike in North Jersey. This is Dave in the city. We hope you enjoyed it tonight. And we wish you good night for the moment. But we will be back. We think it'll be about 2 weeks from now. If it might be, you know, if something breaks, we can come on sooner. But until then, we hope you enjoyed it. Don't forget about the retrospectives we've had commemorating our 10 years on the air. So have a good one, everybody. You can find us at DidCal on Twitter, on the web at DidCal.com. We'll see you next time.